Infertility is a tough topic at the best of times, but when it comes to male infertility, the stigma can have big consequences for starting a family because fertility is often viewed as a, and I'm using air quotes here, a woman's problem. It's the view of many in the community, but also in the medical profession. Well, new guidelines aim to change this. They're actually the first Australian guidelines to inform how doctors approach male infertility. So today, we're talking about it because even with the guidelines, we need to remove the stigma. And you'll hear from the lead author of those recommendations very shortly. But first, Jason Wiley's story of infertility is one that he's keen to share. Jason, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me, Tegan.
So when did you start to go, oh, no, something's happening. We're not, we maybe have an infertility journey that we're on here.
We started to try and conceive about a year into being married. And then it took, everyone sort of said, oh, it'll take some time, don't stress. You know, it's a process. So probably about a year in, we were like, okay, we need to go and have some conversations. So my wife initially got checked, and it came back that everything was all clear and fine on her side of things. So then it was my turn to go to the GP and, get a referral to have my sperm checked, and that came back really low. So then we're like, oh, wow, what's next? What do we need to do? And we were sort of said, well, this is the IVF is the path to go, and away you go. Here's your referral. So that was sort of our first step of like, okay, things aren't going to be easy for us.
And then what happened? You started going through IVF?
Yeah, so we were initially, get checked again. So then you have to go through and get your checked by the IVF sperm facility. So we did that. Yep, you're low. This is your option. This is what you have to do. Let's get started straight away. And we were still fairly young. You know, we're in our early 30s at this stage. So we decided that it was best for us to actually pause and take some time to say, well, this isn't the right time for us, and let's come back when it is the right time. So this was in sort of 2018. We decided to actually start again in 2020 and start that process again. So we had to go through all the checks again and all the tests again, but we felt like we were more ready to do that process and more mentally prepared. And then, yeah, it was the same results. So we were off to get all the drugs, and that was probably really heavy on my wife's side rather than for me. You just sort of stand off to the side and wait for your turn if you do need to freeze some sperm or have some stuff ready on the day. But, yeah, I was a real bystander in that process for a long period of time.
And then you got a good surprise.
Yeah, we did, yeah. So we sort of thrived in COVID. I think we were both working from home, we're eating well, exercising really well and really in a great space. And so we actually ended up conceiving naturally. So my wife, Elise, was ready to inject the drugs when her period came, as the process is, but that never came. So we'd fallen pregnant naturally. And when we went back to the IVF doctor, she was really surprised and shocked. And I retested my sperm and she's like, you're at, you know, a normal rate. Not sure what happened, and these things can happen because there was, as she sort of said, there's not a lot of information in male infertility, and they really don't know a lot of the answers from time to time. So yeah, it was a really nice surprise. So we never actually really had to do much the first time round when we conceived.
So you've got this beautiful little bub, wonderful result. You start trying for a second child naturally, you had to go back to IVF, and you were saying that in this whole process you felt like a bit of a bystander. What happened to sort of shift the focus back onto you?
Yeah, so part of having low sperm is you have to get regular checks on your testicles because you might be you're sort of a precursor, I think it's my understanding, for something else to happen. So you might have calcifications or maybe a testicular cancer or something like that. So I was getting regular checkups and ultrasounds, and the guy doing the ultrasound one day said, you've got a really large bag or seal here, and like that can be removed. And
what's, I was like, oh, sorry, what's that word you just said?
Vagaroseal, I think Dr. Katz, when he's on, will probably say it a bit better. But from my understanding, it's like a vagus vein in your testicles that's quite large, and there's a lot of tissue around the vein. So he's like, yeah, if it ever painful, like you can get it removed. And mine wasn't necessarily providing a lot of discomfort or anything. I just thought, oh, okay. And then that was in my notes And then I mentioned it to my GP and he's like, yeah, you could look into that. But he's like, I'm not an expert in that area. So yeah, maybe you could. And it wasn't until we did a couple of rounds of IVF that were unsuccessful. Our egg quality was really low. My wife was having some issues with the reactions to the drugs in the process. We unfortunately had an ectopic pregnancy as part of the process as well, which was really hard to work through. My wife started speaking to a fertility nurse and she said, I really think you should explore this further, the vagus seal and what you can do there. So we found another doctor, Dr. Rob, who then referred us on to Dr. Katz, who was able to sort of say, yeah, this is something you can actually get removed and it can impact on male infertility. So that was the sort of process we went through in the short version.
So you had the surgery, spoiler alert, you have two boys. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
You really sort of IVF, as you're alluding to, it's the physical burden's very much on your wife. And what I'm also hearing in your story is just the drip of time elapsing in a phase of life that time is really of the essence.
Yeah. So I think from the start, about a 7-year period for us to have two sort of successful pregnancies, both being natural, but having to go through this emotional and stressful toll of what IVF was, when, you know, if we'd known more earlier, we really could have avoided that whole journey. I don't think we certainly would never change our outcome of our two beautiful young boys, but we would certainly not want to be involved in that process if we could.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the aim of new guidelines that have recently been released to focus a bit more on male infertility. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. That's Jason's story. One text says the doctors always do often invasive tests on the woman first. Simple, non-invasive sperm check would be good for the first investigation. Also, the woman often feels that it's her fault. Well, with me is Associate Professor Darren Katz. He's a urologist and a male fertility specialist, and he's one of the experts responsible for these new guidelines. And Darren, you're actually, Jason's one of your patients as well.
No, he is. And thank you to Jason for being so brave and telling his story. I mean, a lot of men suffer in silence with this problem. And thank you so much, Jason, and also you, Tegan, for airing this incredibly important topic, which I'm very, very passionate about, and that is male infertility.
Yeah. I mean, listening to Jason's story, I'm imagining it's not an uncommon story that you're hearing at your clinic.
No, I hear it time and again, and there are several touch points in his fertility journey which are very relevant to these new guidelines. The first thing, and which you've said, and it's come up again with your listeners and also with Jason, is that when a couple presents for infertility, you're right, it's always the female that's sent off for a whole gamut of testing. She's investigated. That can be a long delay, unnecessary tests sometimes, and then eventually someone says, well, everything's normal, maybe we should check the male, and then you just happen to find a problem. Tegan, in Australia, one in six couples are suffering from infertility, and in 50%, there's a male factor which contributes to that couple's infertility, and in 30%, it is the sole cause. So this is such an incredibly, unfortunately, common problem. It's something that can really is important that patients and doctors managing fertility appreciate that there's help out there for lots of guys in Australia.
I'd imagine that given that there does seem to be this imbalance in at least the way people understand male infertility, that even getting people into your clinic is a challenge.
No, look, it is. And unfortunately, there is a bit of a stigma around infertility. I've published some papers on this where the psychological impact of male infertility on a patient, it's a real hit to a patient's masculinity. But it really shouldn't be. This is a common problem. And part of these guidelines is really just to try and raise awareness that this is a problem, that there is help out there for guys. And it shouldn't be something that they should be, as Jason said, it was put in a corner, you felt like a bystander. It shouldn't be like that. This is a couple's problem. Couples should be treated together. And in fact, one of our first guideline statements, i.e. one of the first recommendations, there are 80 in these first ever guidelines, is that when a couple presents to a doctor for infertility, both the male and the female should be assessed concurrently at the same time. So incredibly important, simple, and I think we'll have a profound change into how male infertility is managed in Australia.
So these guidelines, like you say, they're extensive. They're mostly for doctors, but for people who are needing them, what sort of care should they expect? What sort of things should they feel entitled to ask for?
So it's quite simple. I think if the take-home messages are is that this is often a couple's problem. In half the time, it can be a male factor. So the simple thing to do is if you, as a couple, present to your doctor with infertility, I think the first thing to do is to ask for a semen test, because that's often a big window into a male's fertility potential. And that is the first thing that I think a patient should be asking.
What do you hope these recommendations achieve?
So, look, when I first went and did a subspecialty training in America, I went to a place called Cornell, which is a major male fertility centre in New York. And there I realised there were just so many sort of advancements in male infertility that I didn't even know of or came across here during my training. So I brought some of these back to Australia, some of these sort of, you know, advanced techniques and operations and different approaches for treatment of male infertility. And I slowly began to try and sort of change the way that male infertility was managed in Australia. But to be honest, trying to change entrenched practices of doctors in medicine is actually quite difficult. And I think one of the reasons for that, Tegan, is because male infertility in this country can be fragmented, and the same patient presenting with the same problem can often have inconsistent care. And when we compare ourselves to Europe and in America, both of these continents have well-established guidelines that medical practitioners can call on. These have been around for over 20 years now, and they're serially updated. These are all evidence-based. So about 3 years ago, a panel of experts got together, and a big shout-out to them. Honestly, Tegan, this was a team effort. There were six other experts on this panel, and without them, these guidelines would have never come to fruition. And we got together, and we started to develop these first-ever Australian guidelines for managing infertility. So there are, as I mentioned, there are 80 of them. They're all evidence-based. And importantly, they're all endorsed by key stakeholder organisations throughout the infertility arena. They're endorsed by the Urological Society of Australia and New Zealand, of which I'm a part of. They're endorsed by the Fertility Society of Australia and New Zealand, which are the IVF specialists. Also, they're endorsed by the Endocrine Society of Australia, as well as Healthy Male, which is funded by the Australian Department of Health. And they actually really provide a lot of the background support and help and led the charge in this important endeavour. And because they're endorsed by key stakeholder organisations, I think this is going to be really a game changer, because they're going to be widely adopted and a game changer as to how male infertility moving forward will be managed in our country.
Darren, thank you so much for joining me today. Associate Professor Darren Katz is a urologist and male fertility specialist. He's the lead author of these new guidelines on male infertility. And thank you also to Jason Wiley for sharing your story.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.